recorded alert. This meeting is being recorded by the host for a participant window. The account owner can also watch this recording if it ticket account owner link. Got it working. Zoom meeting.
Okay.
You better tell everybody they've got to get that got it button or they won't be able to unmute.
So if you can't mute or unmute, you need to swipe to the got it button. Deanna, you are unmuted.
Yes, she
was. And Deborah, you're unmuted.
Am I?
Yes. Alice, would you like to say something before we officially start? Or do you want us to just go ahead?
Deanna would start.
Okay.
Whatever you need to do.
Yeah, I don't. All right. Take it away.
Well, I can go. I'm ready. This is Alice Massa, and I'm delighted to welcome all of you here this evening to our fifth Bow book launch. And behind our eyes is the sponsoring organization. Behind our eyes has a number of branches. And our newest branch, the Bow book launch, is what you are all here for this evening. And we are delighted that tonight our Bow book launch is spotlighting Deanna Quietwater Noriega and her wonderful book that I've enjoyed reading at least twice, 50 Years of Walking with Friends. And Deborah Kendrick is going to be the interviewer this evening, and Annie Chiappetta is our technical person and host for the evening. So at this time, Deborah, I'm glad to turn the microphone over to you.
Well, thank you so much, Alice, and thank you, Deanna, for the opportunity to be part of this event in welcoming this wonderful book. And you. I'll just briefly, most of you have probably seen the bio, but it's so nice. I'll just briefly read some of Deanna's background. Deanna Quietwater Noriega is half Apache and a quarter Chippewa. She is the mother of two daughters and an adopted blind son. She was the eldest of five children in a close-knit American Indian family. As a result of congenital glaucoma, she became totally blind at the age of 8. Deanna was mainstreamed in public schools in Texas, Michigan, and California. She completed a bachelor's degree in social science and did a year toward a master's in social work at California State University, Stanislaus. While attending college, she taught independent living skills for the blind for California Department of Vocational Rehabilitation. She worked as a caseworker in Santa Clara County, California, before joining the United States Peace Corps. Deanna and her sighted husband met while attending college, and he joined her in the Peace Corps. They worked together to establish a school for blind children in the independent nation of Western Samoa. Upon her return to the United States, Deanna spent the next 7 years at home raising children. During this time, she became active in the American Council of the Blind, Guide Dog Users Incorporated, taught Braille, instructed breastfeeding mothers as a La Leche leader, was a friendly visitor at nursing homes, and worked as a volunteer intake clerk at the welfare office. Deanna and her husband opened two Papa Murphy's pizza franchise stores. She served as operations manager, doing inventory, ordering, supervising staff, and handling the cash register and phone during late afternoons and evenings. After 14 successful years, they sold the restaurants to move to Colorado, where their two daughters were enrolled in college. She kept busy working as an instructor of blind and independent living skills with an adult education program. I'm going to stop there. Deanna has done many things in terms of advocacy and teaching, but we're mostly here to celebrate her writing. And her writing has appeared in magazines such as Dialogue, Angels on Earth, the Braille Forum, Generations Native Literature, the Vision Aware blog, and others. Oh, as well as the most important to this group, Shame on Me, Anthologies Behind Our Eyes, Stories, Poems, and Essays by Writers with Disabilities, and Behind Our Eyes, A Second Look, and Anthology Light, My Blindness Isn't Black, where we read the wind, turning the clocks forward again in storm country. There is just so much to say. I must say that I decided there was so much I wanted to cover with Deanna that I wasn't going to do notes because I would be disappointed. So we're just, I told her we're just going to have a conversation, and she speaks so beautifully and writes so beautifully that we'll definitely cover some of the right things. So this book, Deanna describes as being a book about guide dogs. Well, briefly, she says that this book covers my life with 9 guide dogs trained at the Seeing Eye. But, you know, we will talk about these dogs, but the important thing here is that this is really not so much just a book about these wonderful dogs as a book about blindness and life and family and being different and just so many beautiful things. And Deanna does this wonderful smorgasbord kind of thing of rolling all of these ingredients together into this really beautiful book. So, and I have to say a bit of self-indulgence before I start grilling her, and to say that I could get myself into trouble saying this publicly, but I have read many memoirs of blind people, and I have read many books about guide dogs. And I think this is my favorite. So, and I think part of that is because our experiences are so parallel. It's just amazing to me the number of parallels. Now, Deanna doesn't remember this, so I'm going to embarrass her and put her on the hot seat. It came up in a group a few months ago that we were pen pals back when she lived in Grants Pass, Oregon, and she had a little baby girl and I had a little baby girl, and I think we both had guide dogs, and only she had a son from Samoa. And I just remember really looking forward to these Braille letters from this amazing woman who had been in the Peace Corps and who, just like me, was involved in breastfeeding and raising babies. And so I've been a fan of Deanna for a very long time. And I could add a lot more personal notes to that too, that I may get into later when I ask some of these questions about your heritage. But for those who have not had the good fortune of reading this book, I thought the best way to begin, the book tells the story of these 9 beautiful guide dogs and all the beautiful people who were part of Deanna's life along the way. But she opens the book with a tribute poem to her mother, which is so lovely. And Deanna, if you would, I would just love for you to read that poem.
Okay. Every year I try to write a poem for my mother for Mother's Day. And it's just something I do. And she's always been one of my big fans. She was the force between my going to college in the first place when she said, baby girl, you can't wait tables, you can't pump gas, you can't work in the soap factory, so you'd better go to college. So she was a big influence throughout life. And so the poem I put in the book isn't the last one. I've written several since then, but it's the one that kind of captures a little bit of who she is and what she's like, or was. She's now 91 and she's sinking into dementia. So she has aphasia now. So when I call, I usually try to do something on the call to make her laugh, or I'll sing to her, because sometimes she can sing back, you know. So if I, you know, that's one of the ways we still can communicate, is if I can make her laugh by reminding her of something we did as kids, then I know she's understanding, even if she can't find the words to respond. So I wrote the poem, Mama's Hands, for her. Let's see, I've got to find it. I've got it here, just. Okay, I dedicated it to my first trainer and to my husband, my children, my friends, and my mother, who loved and taught me so much about how to live, love, and flourish. So, Mama's hands. Mama's hands are long, slender, and graceful. The veins stand out on their backs, and their joints are growing a little stiff. They show the signs of the years and the hard tasks they have performed. As my world began to grow gray and hazy, Mama's hand was strong and slim, grasping mine. When I was sick, her hand was cool against my brow. Mama's hands knit me bright sweaters to keep me warm. Mama's hands were clever, making our home a pleasant place. Mama's hands moved quickly, rolling tortillas, sewing on buttons, stretching taffy. Mama's hands were gentle, smoothing back my hair, tapping my nose when she said, "Look at me." Though delicate and slender, they were strong enough to conquer any task. They now show the passage of the years. Mama's hands are beautiful because they're not the pampered hands of the idle, but the working tools of a loving heart.
I have
one more poem I can share you. I wrote this for, I'll read it to her on Saturday, because I call her every Saturday. And that's the reason I wrote this book, was because my mother was turning 90 last February.
Has read the book, or is
yes, yes. When I was able to go visit her, she picked up the book, and at that time she could still talk, and she read me a passage that she liked. And that was a very great joy.
I want to ask you some questions about writing, sure. though, about sure. writing. We'll come back to that. Yeah. I'll give you an opportunity to read that. But so 50 years is a long time, Deanna. This is, you know, basically your whole life. And you have one of your greatest gifts as a writer, I think, is to capture a moment with a few words, and using various sentences there in the poem. You say, tapping my nose. That is just brilliant. You just can see the mother and the blind child, you know. It's just great. But you do that again and again and again throughout. So what I want to know is, how did you go about reclaiming these memories? And I know some of the pieces you say they were written elsewhere, but even so, to put this whole book together, you had to do a lot of revisiting, remembering. Did you have any techniques that you used, or did you have conversations with other people to recreate those moments in 1968 and 75 and 82?
No, it's just that, you know, pivotal moments, I do tend to write things down. And I have a file on my computer. And of course, this isn't the same computer I started out with. In 1968, I went off to college with a manual typewriter, a lot of strike white strips, and a Braille writer, and a reel-to-reel tape recorder. So then I wrote things down in Braille. So I had scraps of things. And when I started keeping things on a computer, I have a file that I just call musings. And so that's where pieces of things just get stored until I need them and can develop them further. It's not quite a journal because each piece is just, it's not dated, but I know if I'm talking about, you know, this dog or that dog or this happening or that happening, I know when they were. So it's just a matter of pulling this stuff together, organizing it chronologically, and running it past my small writing group, who were a great help at polishing, because a lot of it was, well, it was all, and that was another thing. When I did send it off to my editor, it was in all different fonts and all kinds of things. Been written over such a long period of time, and they just transferred from computer to computer in my writing files.
Did you have any conversations to confirm bits of memory, you know, with your husband, your friends, your other family members? Did you do any of that? Like,
not really. With the five of us, we are scattered all over the country. And when we've been together, we're great talkers and storytellers. And so a lot of memories we brought up that way in shared, you know, humor, stories about what he did or she did or whatever. And I've found it amazing that the five of us could have been raised in the same household and remember things completely differently. So all I could do is base it on what I remember.
Excellent. And actually, everything you read about memoir, that seems to be the absolute solid ground. One thing that everybody agrees upon is that nobody remembers history the same way. So as I said, there were so many parallels for me that was just amazing. I mean, we're of the same generation. I was a few years after you in getting my first guide dog, and you know, each thing was maybe a little bit later, but so much synchronicity that I kept, oh my gosh, That too. I mean, even the sequence of dogs was similar. So I've had only 8, not 9. But what the one thing I thought, and I just had to ask this, knowing we have other guide dog handlers in the audience, did you make up some of these names, or were you truly that lucky that you got 9 amazingly good names for your dog?
Nope. When I got Phoebe was the only time I said, what? And that was before Friends. So it wasn't a very popular name. And all I could think of this was this very prissy older lady, you know. But she was a very serious guide dog and very dignified. So it kind of fit.
You really got those 9 names. Mm-hmm. You are a lucky girl. Those are lovely names. Lovely names to go with lovely dogs. I'm sure you've heard this before. You are so charmingly positive, but have there been times when people have asked you not to be so positive?
I live with a man whose glass is always half empty. So it's a constant balancing act to keep my sense of humor. But balance is important to me. And one of my balancers, of course, is my great-grandmother gifting me the name of Quiet Water, because she said water can be soft, but water is very strong. Even when it's just a trickle, it goes under things, it goes over things, it goes through them. Water is unstoppable because it's life. And to be given that kind of a name was a great source of strength to me, because all I had to do was remember who I was. And even when people said horrible things or misunderstood my actions, or, you know, friends were not the friends I thought they were, things like that, I could always recenter myself and say, okay, that happened. I won't let it happen again. And it's their problem, not mine.
we're introducing the era of 1968 is one of the clearest, most concise and accurate summations I think I've read. It was just lovely. And you tell a story of early on in college of a circle of girls being together, and this was the time of civil rights and a social justice awakening for our country, and someone saying some disparaging things and how you handled that. Can you tell us that story?
Well, I was shocked, first of all, that she thought that that was an appropriate thing to say in front of a group of girls who had just barely met. We were all new freshmen, and she'd invited us to her dorm room and passed out cookies her mom had baked, and she had some sun tea that she poured into cups, and we were sitting around in her room on the floor, and I was leaning against her closet door with another girl that I had just met. And we'd hit it off right away the first day, because we were both there on scholarship. The both of us were the first ones in our family to go to college. Both of us were the eldest of five and came from blue collar families. And so we just had so much in common that we sort of recognized each other and said, oh, we're going to be friends on that very first day in the dorm. And we're sitting there, and this young woman, whose father was a policeman in Los Angeles, said some disparaging things about the two dorm monitors on the two halls that came together in like an L shape. And one of them was a beautiful, elegant young Black woman, and the other one was a very sweet Hispanic girl. And she made some comments about affirmative action and, you know, stuff like that, that indicated she didn't think they had any right to be there. And so I just stood up and said, well, I don't think then I should be here either then, because I'm Native American. And I got my dog and I walked out, and my new friend Annie jumped up and came with me. She says, me either, but she was a blue-eyed blonde. But
pretty compelling, you know, and pretty impressive that you had that kind of courage at such a young age. When did you start realizing that you had sort of this double difference of being blind and Native American? I mean, do you remember a time when you started thinking about it? I think
when I started school as a blind child at age 8, and I was treated so differently by the teachers and everything, and I could tell that they thought I was this, oh, poor little thing, and that wasn't who I was. I was the Winona, my mother's firstborn daughter. her second pair of hands. I was the big sister who, you know, took care of my younger brothers when she was at work, kind of a latchkey situation. And they may have been quicker than I was and able to climb fast and run away. But I would just stand there and put my hands on my hips and say, you'd better come back here and mind and do what I say, because I know where you sleep. I would just let them know that they could get away with it temporarily. But since we lived in the same house and I was the big sister, they'd better darn well mind and you know, do what I said, because I was in charge till Mama came home or until one of my older relatives was around, like a grandparent, an uncle, or, you know, somebody else that was a grown-up. I was in charge.
Your siblings read your book?
My brother Rob is closest to me in age, and he's very tenderhearted. And he said he had a hard time reading it because he didn't like some of the hard parts in it. Things that happened to me that I didn't tell anyone.
Right.
I did soften a bit of some of the rough edges, because I knew that since I was writing it for my mother, I didn't want her to feel. My mother is also a very tenderhearted person. And that was the one thing that kept us in line as five little monsters running unsupervised, you know, for hours each day, was the fact that we never wanted to disappoint our mother and make her cry, because then she would feel it was all her fault because she wasn't able to stay home with us.